Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about books and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased to be talking by telephone today with Stella Baratlis, Poet Laureate of Modesto, California, and librarian at the Tracy Library of the Stockton-San Joaquin County Public Library. We're going to be talking with Stella about her two callings, librarian and poet, and about her new book of poems, Alkali Sink. Hello, Stella.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
It is really great to be talking. You know, I think you're the first public librarian I've had on the program, and I idolize public librarians, being an academic librarian. I don't feel somehow as on the front lines as you all do. And then, of course, I idolize poets also, so it's great to have, it's great to have one person who's both. It's also great to be talking after following your Facebook posts, you know, for I think about a year or two now. They're always really interesting, you know, sort of an adventure to read your Facebook site. And thanks to Siddhartha Lokanandi for introducing us virtually on Facebook.
Yes, Siddhartha, yes.
Yeah. His posts are great, too. Interesting.
Yeah, oh, definitely. So. Lovely man.
And then congratulations on your poet laureate status, which is quite an honor, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. Yeah. And I didn't realize that I wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
My good friend Gillian Wegner had been poet laureate for the previous 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she is so wonderful at writing poems, occasional poems. And I thought, there's just no way anyone can follow this act, mm-hmm. especially me. But I also felt really strongly that the city needed to have a literary kind of ambassador, I guess. And so I didn't know if others were going to step up to do that. So I tossed my hat into the ring, and I was appointed in July of this year. So it's pretty recent.
Yeah. And does it last for a while?
There's a 2-year term,
uh-huh.
and I think they can appoint me for another term. That's in their rules of poet laureateship for City of Modesto.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's minimal responsibilities.
Yeah.
I am supposed to read a poem for the city council
uh-huh.
at their request, and some of the examples of occasions upon which I might be called to read include the opening of a new building or the appointment of new city council members.
Yeah, so ceremonial
and then
occasions,
yeah. Yes, yeah. And I'm also required to submit a poem to the city's annual poetry contest. It's called Poets Corner,
uh-huh.
and that is a countywide poetry contest for all age groups, and the Poet Laureate traditionally has a poem in the little resultant booklet.
Yeah, it sounds like a great tradition.
It is.
So it makes me wonder about Modesto. You know, it seems, a fine thing that they would have a poet laureate. You know, not all towns do. I don't think we do here in Poughkeepsie. And I wonder if it's an indicator of it being a place where the arts are taken seriously or where there's a thriving literary artistic community.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Modesto, many people are surprised to learn that the Central Valley in general
mm-hmm.
is a thriving literary spot.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many poets from the Central Valley, and I am now learning many authors as well who write a variety of genres, fiction and nonfiction. And Fresno, I think, is kind of the pinnacle of Central
yeah.
Valley poetry towns, and Modesto is a second, definitely, and maybe even a rival mm-hmm. to Fresno. And it's really surprising given that we don't have a major university in
mm-hmm.
our town. Fresno has Cal State University Fresno, CSU Fresno. Modesto has the wonderful Modesto Junior College,
mm-hmm.
a California community college with a great English department
yeah.
and really talented instructors who are also poets. Lillian Valley comes to mind. She's retired now as an English professor at MJC, but people don't know that she has translated Czesław Miłosz
mm-hmm.
and even was a student of his. And she's really well known internationally.
Uh-huh.
And here she is living in Modesto. So I would say that, yes, Modesto definitely has a thriving literary community. And it's just a surprise. It's a surprise for many people to discover them.
Yeah.
one of its saving graces.
Yeah. I associate it with John Steinbeck. That's even the word mm-hmm. probably first popped into my consciousness when I was probably in junior IR high school reading, you know, Steinbeck.
Uh-huh. Right.
And he is associated with the town, isn't he, in some way, in the whole valley there?
Right, the valley, and maybe even more, you know, Steinbeck is connected with the Central California area, which is Salinas. Mm-hmm. It's about 2-3 hours south of Modesto.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit closer to the coast, but definitely Central Valley, the landscapes and the people, the farm workers, that is something that's a common thread.
Yeah.
For sure, all throughout the Central Valley.
I'm an art librarian, so I have heard the term Central Valley modern in terms of architectural styles. So you must mm-hmm. have a slew of mid-century modern structures there and architects associated with the place, apart from the fact that I know there are people like Frank Lloyd Wright and William Munster and I think Bernard Maybeck and Julia Morgan who work mm-hmm. in the area too.
Modesto has had for the past several years an architecture festival,
ah.
which has been really fun, where people lead groups of participants on architecture walks around the college neighborhood, oh. around the older downtown neighborhoods. I wrote a poem as part of the architecture festival. There was an exhibit at a downtown gallery of photographs of well-known Modesto buildings and then poems about the buildings.
Oh.
And so I was a part of an event there a couple of years ago, and the building which I was assigned to write about, to write uh-huh. a poem about, was a bank building, and I forget the title of it now, but it's a beautiful, I don't think it's Central Valley modern.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think it was built in the 60s,
uh-huh.
but it has this, it's just very interesting, and it has an interesting history and a gorgeous interior, and it's been vacant for several years.
Uh-huh.
And I just sometimes go down there and look through the glass in the front and just think, I want to go in there. And
it's a nice tradition, matching up poets and buildings, I think it seems to me it is. So.
Yeah, it's really, it's very challenging for the
yeah.
poet, I know,
yeah.
because it forces me to research details yeah. about the place and find a way in to think of a line or a phrase that will kind of unlock a potential poem for me.
Yeah, interesting. We have someone on the faculty here, Yvonne Ouellette, who writes on Renaissance buildings and Renaissance poetry, where there are poems evidently that served, before there was such a thing as a building program, poems that served as building programs and sort of laid out for the architect what the patron wanted, and then, you know, the architect
really?
Would work, yeah, from the poem. It was, you know, it's an interesting concept.
That's fascinating.
I want to go on and talk about your poetry, but
okay.
first I want to ask you about your job as a librarian. You work in
a
branch public library?
Yes, I do. I work at the Tracy Branch Library, and the library is the second busiest branch in my system, the Stockton-San Joaquin County Library System.
Mm-hmm.
And the population's about 90,000, and the building is at this point much too small for the population. And so we have lots of people in and out the doors, and we're also located in the same area as a public park in the city of Tracy.
Mm.
And so it's really, you know, a heavily traveled library,
yeah.
heavily used library. And there's, I feel like I have to be ready for anything because it's not just people coming in and asking for, you know, information.
Mm-hmm.
it's like being out in the middle of the public park.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You get people all ages, then I would expect children and senior
yes.
citizens.
Yes,
and, yeah.
children, people with babies asking us, what programs do you have for toddlers?
Yeah.
Do you have anything for senior citizens? Do you have Braille or talking books here? Do you have schematics for a 1949 Chevy pickup? I mean, it can be anything. And you have to sort of be ready, like nice and calm and ready to, you know, anticipating anything on any given day.
Yeah, that's great. Can't be that much to knowing everything about everything, but
yeah, no right, problem. So, we got
yeah.
this.
yeah, and to be a kind of community organizer too. You know, I'm a big fan of David
yeah.
Lankes here at Syracuse in New York, who defines uh-huh. librarians as radical agents of positive change. And
yes.
by that he means educators. I mean, education is in and of itself how radical
yes.
change takes place.
Absolutely.
So, you know, for him, being a librarian is about empowering people, and it's about communities empowering themselves. And so, you know, you've got an important role there then, don't you?
I aspire to that in my work as a public librarian, and I'm trying to create partnerships with community organizations and connect them with resources that they might need. And in a lot of cases, there are all these groups that are working towards similar goals, but they don't know of each other's existence, or they're competing, and I feel like the library has a role here to help the groups partner, or maybe for the library even to be the kind of connective tissue that makes a bigger action or a larger goal possible.
Yeah, sort of orchestrating things.
Right. I mean, we're such a trusted public institution that we are well positioned to make things happen, you know, and people don't suspect our motives. And it's all about giving access to information that's already there, and sometimes it's very difficult to unravel or uncover.
And your role as a librarian is important there, isn't it? It's not just about having books where people can come look things up, is it? But Lankus has this quote, you know, a great building full of books is just a warehouse, but a closet with a librarian in it is a library. Anyway, your role as a librarian is important, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel I have a responsibility in my role in the city of Tracy as the town librarian, definitely. And I'm relatively new there. I just started in late January of this year, and my sense was that the library was really keeping a low profile and was very comfortable operating as that place for books and for resources. And when the community reached out and tried to, you know, utilize the library for various things, there's a sense of ownership of the resources of the library, so that it's sometimes hard to give up control or to hand over the reins to your community and let them drive what you do. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, sure.
And so I'm trying to find ways to make this happen at my library, and the changes have been pretty striking right off the bat. Instead of being so focused on our processes and our building and bringing people into our building to do library things and being concerned with our gate count, I'm trying very slowly to foster this organizational change. So that we understand that the only reason we're there is to serve the community. We should be going to them. So I'm trying to do more outreach, and I think that's the way to increase access to library resources.
Yeah, sure. That's what empowerment means in a way, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And there are so many people who are willing to come in and share their knowledge with others at the public library. And it's been difficult to find ways to make this work so that all of the requirements are fulfilled as far as the administration and people who are volunteering at the library, volunteering their talents and time, and incorporating all that with our regular services that we offer, that we're expected to offer. So it's been a little bit challenging. I realized that we're changing, and so some of it is going to look messy, but it's very much worth it. And it's hard sometimes, because I would like to live in a more certain and precise world.
Yeah, well, you're a librarian, so organized.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I think all of us deal with that. So, but anyway, it sounds rewarding, certainly.
It is really rewarding, and it's completely, I have to say, it's some days I come home from work and I'm totally drained, because I put a lot of energy into what I do there, and I realize, like, okay, you might need to save some for yourself. So you don't burn out.
No, you have to nourish yourself so you can't help other people. So,
And I have to keep writing poetry, too,
so you
need to save some for that.
Yes. So, yeah, well, you have two identities there, professions, ways of being in the world. If you think of a profession as, you know, professing something, meaning spreading the word, which is how I think of librarians as professionals. And, of course, poets are all about that. Also, you're all about language. So anyway, did you come to both at the same time, or did you follow different paths?
That's a great question. The poet has always been there. I have been writing on and off since I was a child, and my interest in librarianship started when I worked as first a clerk and then a library assistant with the Stanislaus County Library System in the late 90s. And my writing in earnest began in 2000. So they're kind of connected time-wise. And I started writing seriously when I was pregnant with my daughter, actually. Mm-hmm. And I started growing as a writer and reading poetry, more mm-hmm. poetry. And, you know, meeting yeah. on a regular basis with a writing group and sharing work that I had so that I was accountable to a group. And so I was producing new work.
Yeah.
Of course, it's much easier before the child comes.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah. But you've got something to write about after yeah. the child comes, so yes.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yes. So. Yeah. So, yeah, they're definitely related. My work in the library and being connected to information and facts, and also learning that librarianship is more than the book. You know, yeah. it's very much about reading and books, of course, yeah. but there's definitely a bigger element to the profession. And so I learned a lot of things in the library that gave me words and phrases and interests, you know, curiosities that yeah. I wanted to explore in poems.
Ah, yeah, that's interesting. There have been a lot of famous poets who have been librarians. I mean, Philip Larkin comes to mind, and Borges,
right.
of course, was actually a branch librarian in Buenos Aires. And
that's right.
Locally, the poet Audre Lorde, you know, comes to mind, who worked nearby in the Mount Vernon Public Library system. And so, you know, you mentioned you become curious about things. I wonder if there's a connection there. And of course, you know, when you're writing about something, even if you're just thinking about a word and exploring its ramifications, you're doing a kind of research. You know, you're asking
yes.
questions, aren't you? And it reminds me, as a librarian, in a way, of reference work. You know, someone asks you a question, but it may not be the right question, so you have to get at the right question, and then there will be
yes.
layers of answers that you dredge
that's
up.
That's really, on. Yeah, that's a great observation, that sometimes you articulate it as you go along, right?
Yeah.
You articulate the patron's need when you're a reference librarian because they have difficulty explaining what they want because they often don't know. They have a very murky notion of what they might need. And then through a process, you uncover that or you arrive at it together. So there's a process happening when you're working with somebody. A lot of times I've found, I was an academic librarian at Modesto Junior College and also at CSU Stanislaus.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced that on a regular basis with people, maybe in a master's program, and they were writing a paper on something and they thought that they knew what their topic was, but you know, they really needed to talk to somebody about it to sort of get an idea of what they actually wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And often that's the librarian that's at the reference desk.
Yeah.
And so I see a parallel in that process with my writing process,
mm-hmm.
which is super intuitive to me. And when I first started writing, I questioned it a lot, like, well, shouldn't I know what I'm writing about, you know, mm-hmm. before I put my pen to the paper or, you know, before I open up my Microsoft Word
yeah.
and start typing. But I now know that that's just how I work, and I trust that there is a process happening that I don't have necessarily access to
mm-hmm.
in my kind of conscious thinking. So there's something going on.
Uh-huh.
There's working over an idea, kind of the same way that dreams work, right? You know, your brain is processing bits of information that you receive throughout the day or whatever.
Yeah.
Such as a national election. And you wonder what that nightmare was all about.
Yeah.
So as I'm writing, a lot of times it unfolds for me what mm-hmm. I'm actually writing about is not the thing that I started with. The thing that I started with was an edge or a corner of a greater message or an emotion that I want to explore or an event that I want to look at. And not necessarily tell a direct narrative about an event, but to explore how it fits a bigger pattern or what else it might mean
yeah.
aside from the obvious.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no,
so,
no, it makes
so
perfect
I guess
sense.
I'm making, the parallel is you don't know necessarily what your question is when you set out. I don't know what it is when I set out to work on it, but I trust that it's going to eventually emerge, and the part of the joy for me in writing is the surprise.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, wow, that's what it was.
It's a sort of fluid process, isn't it? There's a word, not iterative, but when you're following a road that winds.
Yeah, I think iterative captures it well.
So, well, libraries are notoriously, supposedly, you know, because we're always shushing people, supposedly, you know, quiet places. They can be anyway. And the idea there is that it requires a kind of quiet, and the library is then a kind of refuge so that one can explore oneself. You know, it requires a kind of withdrawal from stimulation, doesn't it?
So, absolutely.
When you write poetry, do you require that yourself? A library is probably a pretty decent place for most poets to work, I would.
If you have any sort of breaks or downtime, it's great. But I mean, right, having that in my world definitely can count as a quiet place of sorts.
Yeah. So do you have a routine when you do write that you do withdraw?
Yes, there has to be quiet time or some time away from work so that I can stretch out again, so that I can literally decompress. Because the work that I do in the public is so super engaging and a lot of times emotional because of the people who come in and they're in crisis and you're helping them with things and it's very tense. I just feel tense sometimes, even though it's good work. And so I need to have some time away from that activity, and then I can start to pay attention to concerns that I hadn't noticed before because I was so busy with my work, or questions that are interesting to me, or a weird shape that I've been seeing in the trees outside my window, and I want to look at that more in words. And so my process, so yes, I need quiet time. I do carry a notebook around with me. So whenever I go somewhere, I try to remember to bring my notebook with me in my little bag that I carry around and have it out with a pen so that I can write down observations, words that are interesting to me, something that I just want to remember for later. Mm-hmm. So at least I feel like in that way, I'm got my toe into the composition waters. Even though I'm not writing poems yet, I'm collecting ideas and words and phrases that sound interesting to me that I might put into play in a poem. So as long as I've got my notebook and I'm writing things down, then I feel like I'll be ready to write when I finally do have moments or days where I have time and I can put my mind to that.
So anyway, let's talk about then your beautiful book published by 16 Rivers Press here, Alkali Sink. I do like the design, I have to say, this geodetic survey map that you've got on the front.
Right, isn't that wonderful? That was sourced by the book designer that I worked with, Joseph Beery. He found this map at the University of Texas in Austin and their online archives.
Uh-huh.
And it is just the detail of a map of the Los Banos quadrangle from 1916.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wanted that. So he offered to look for a map, right? Because I knew I wanted a map on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And he found this. And the reason why I wanted it to be of Central California. So Los Banos is Merced County, and the map is showing the Stanislaus County and Merced County, the boundary there. That is because nearby that area, there are alkali sink regions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, an alkali sink is a little habitat that's found usually in desert areas, but also in parts of the Central Valley. So I wanted to represent that visually with a map. I love the color of it, and I'm really happy whenever I look at it. I just think this is great.
So the title of your book is Alkali Sink Poems. So this is actually a geologic term. It's not a construction of your own. I wasn't sure because you use
right,
it in one
exactly,
of your
yes.
Yeah, yeah, the book.
When my daughter was young, we used to go to a natural history museum that was run by Modesto Junior College, and it's called the Great Valley Museum, and it was housed in a little, you know, old building on the corner right across the street from the campus, and there was an exhibit in that Great Valley Museum for an alkali sink, and it had I'm forgetting now if it had like a little stuffed fox or something like that in there. It was showing the alkali sink and the animals and the
diorama.
Right, it was a diorama. And I just thought, oh, alkali sink, that is such an interesting term. You know, I like the way that it sounds with the K sound, so alkali sink.
So is Alkali Sink as a collection, is this your first collected book of poems?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is my first book of poetry. I like to say first because, right, that means that there will be others.
Others, yes, yeah.
There will be many, many others.
If you've been writing a long time, it represents a considerable amount of work, and a lot is condensed into this, I think, yes. Yeah.
Right.
So it would be great if you could read something for us from it,
okay.
A few poems.
Okay, I would love to. The first poem that I'd like to read is titled I Heard on the Radio, and the poem describes a demolition of the sugar beet plant. It was the Spreckels plant in Manteca, California. So I was driving around with my then husband, and we were listening to the radio, and the radio announcer was broadcasting live from this site that they were demoing the silos that were there because I guess the property had been sold and it was going to be developed into a shopping center eventually.
Oh, yeah.
But for decades it had been this beet processing plant. And so they were making this big event where they were trying to get people to come and look at the demolition. So some lucky person was going to be able to push down the plunger of the, you know, just like in a cartoon, right?
So
like
raffle,
detonate, right? To set off the charge to detonate the explosive and the whole thing comes down, right? So we were like, oh, we got to go check that out. So we drove there, and it was a kind of a carnival of the grotesque. So that's what this poem is about.
Oh, okay, great.
I heard on the radio.
We are on the radio, too, so.
Perfect. I heard on the radio they are blowing up the sugar plant. So we drive north to a town of old, sharp smells. The nose tells us we've reached Manteca. Olfactory curiosity, but also the clean rows of a Greek farmer's vines. In this town, owl decoys perch on buildings, vigilant with glass eyes. Airstream trailers peek out behind eucalyptus teeth and bid hello to the truck drivers who are always just passing through. We plow through it all, ferment stink as sugar beets roast on slow-moving belts. And behind that odor, the oil burn of gears that turn efficiently 24 hours a day. But today, all this has given way to a man saving his place at the chain-link carnival that surrounds this temple, and a barker who announces the winner of a contest to push the plunger that detonates the charge that begins the demolition we've come to witness. The ceremony starts, a collective twitch as staccato charges snap the air, loosening creaky spines and unlacing steel ribbons. But these old towers hang in the air, stubborn, releasing dust and exhaling possibility. Then the fall and spill upon the earth. When the dust clears, we wander back, desolate, looking for a place, like people wondering where to get their next meal, like the silver pigeons who have lost a good home.
Obviously, you tell a story in a scene, and a lot of your poems have to do with narrative, don't they? And memory.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, memory plays a big part in my work.
And also, you know, what struck me about it, I was talking off the top of my head here, is a few times I've driven in the desert, I've noticed how one landscape will smell very different from another landscape, especially if you're changing elevations. I suppose the foliage changes. So you can kind of tell. If you know the landscape, I expect you can kind of tell where you are just by smelling the air, yes? So.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And there was something about Manteca, which there were, I don't know if it was the Spreckels plant, actually, when you drove past it, there was a very sharp and distinctive odor, and it was not pleasant. And so now, 15, 20 years, I can't remember when the sugar plant went away. But, you know, up until then, every time you drove near on the freeway, even driving past, you could smell where you were. You're like, oh, we're in Manteca, you know, there's that smell. So literally, Manteca really smelled bad. And that's because of the processing that was going on there. And that's gone now. And it's strange. I sort of feel weirdly nostalgic for that now.
That's nice. I've noticed in a lot of your poems, you sometimes take very common objects or objects, things, I suppose is the word, that have their own kind of reality about them, and you present them really clearly, almost like I'm looking at something in desert light without a lot of distraction around it. I mean, a lot of your poetry, the imagery that you use, reads like this to me. And then with a certain care about these things, even if they're kind of obscure things that people ordinarily wouldn't care about, like, you know, an abandoned sugar beet plant, you know, something majestic about the end of this plant, isn't there, the way you describe it? And a kind of sadness here, too.
Well, yeah, that's... I think that there is sadness a lot in this collection of poetry. There was a review of it earlier this year by Joan Gelfand in the Bay Area, and she's a reviewer that looked at the collection in consideration for the Northern California Book Awards.
Uh-huh.
My book was a nominee for that. So alongside Juan Felipe Herrera and Gary Snyder and... I know, it was just amazing. I thought, like, what? Are they sure that they meant to include my book? So she reviewed it, and she said that something that really struck me, she said that this collection, Alkali Sink, could have also been titled Toxic Depression. And I just thought, you know, I don't know if I like that, because I didn't feel, she was just pointing out that there's a lot of sadness and catastrophe even in the works. In the collection.
You know, oddly, I didn't find that. I didn't find the book depressing at all. I mean, there's a sadness about it, but it's a kind of, you know, wistful sadness that you get in the landscape itself, a melancholy kind of maybe. But
that's wonderful. I mean, I feel that, too, in the work, definitely. So that's more what I was hoping.
I mean, it's not what you would call confessional poetry, where there's a lot of angst, I would say, especially because memory does seem to be involved in a lot of your poems.
Well, yeah, and I don't know if emotionally if there's a restraint or, you know, there's definitely a restraint. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, that's great. So let's hear another one. So.
Let's see. So... I'm going to read Memory's Nettles, and let me just, by way of introducing this, share with you that there's a lot of my family history or family story in this poem.
Yeah,
my mom,
Greek.
Greek. My mom was born in Crete, and she came to the USA when she was 20 years old as part of an arranged marriage with my father. And so I grew up, you know, as a child, you know, my mom brought with her all the things that she did when she was growing up in Greece. And one of those things was picking greens on the side of the road. So whenever we were driving from Pleasanton to San Leandro to visit our relatives on my dad's side in the springtime, if she saw these mustard greens growing, we had to stop on the side of the freeway to pick them. So this poem describes a trip back to Greece when my mom and my sister and I all went back for my grandmother's funeral. And we were picking greens in a vacant lot next to my Aunt Leah's house. So Memory's Nettles. Do you remember biting into the soggy forkful of dark stem and leaf, tasting the startling sweetness of Greek mountain afternoon? In that rocky lot dotted with wild cyclamen, your sisters, my aunts, walking slowly, pointing out clumps with their knives. The oldest, my namesake in widow's black, telling the story of boiled nettles. The soldier who, missing his own young daughter, wanted to adopt you. We young women, always the American girls with tied tongues and half-understanding smiles, know nothing except the greens. That day we picked Armira, Italica, Flita, Radicchia, stuffed our weeds into plastic bags and walked to Leah's, where we removed the roots, bathed the greens in a large zinc tub, and tossed them into a pot of boiling water. I... steak knife in my hand, racked my brain for a word. Remember?
Yeah, that's quite nice. So obviously it's about their memories as well as your memory. Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's echoing, right? This is what I failed to mention in my introduction is this is an address to my mother. So the poem, the speaker in the poem is addressing her Greek mother. Uh-huh. And so my mom told me that there was a soldier, you know, when she was a child, you know, Germany occupied Greece, and there was a German soldier who wanted to adopt my mom when she was, you know, a baby. And so that detail is in the middle stanza. And then that's kind of tied in with my sister and I. We're the American girls, and we, going back to Greece as adults, and we have not kept up our Greek language skills.
Uh-huh.
So there's a barrier there with communicating with our family.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever we've gone there, my sis and I, it's in some ways it's a struggle to communicate, to articulate our thoughts, and it's so frustrating to try to come up with the language to communicate clearly with our Greek-speaking relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also something reflected in the words of that poem.
It kind of elides the difference between languages and worlds in a way, with trying to just reach for the right word when you're writing a poem.
Yeah, and the reality of not being able to communicate with words is so frustrating for somebody who loves words, and it's really sad for me that, you know, I have not maintained my Greek language. And so I'm actually taking, my library has Rosetta Stone, and so I'm very slowly working through the Greek language.
Okay, that's great, Stella. So,
program, so.
So, see, libraries are useful, aren't they? So,
absolutely.
As is the internet, so, yeah.
Well, part of what I want to do is, you know, as a poet, I want to translate Greek poets.
Ah.
I mean, that is, you know, the next step of developing my poetry practice is translating. And I know, you know, I grew up with Greek and I'm good with words and language. And so I figure, this will be a great exercise for me. But first I have to really brush up on my Greek, though.
So. Yeah. Oh, interesting. I was just talking to a friend here. We talk philosophy every now and then. I've been reading Heidegger, who's all about his own understanding of Greek and especially pre-Socratic philosophy and trying to pull the sense of meaning that he gets from reading the Greeks into modern philosophy. I've been working with poetry and things, objects of Edna St. Vincent Millay. We're going to have a show here in the spring of her objects from her house museum in Steepletop. And I was trying to write something about things and about poetry also, and I got tangled up in Heidegger's Origin of the Work of Art, which is really kind of a wonderful little essay, not all that difficult to apprehend. And there was a passage in it, I wanted to read it here. I thought I might read it somewhere in our conversation here. When I was reading your poetry, it kept coming to mind because your poetry is very much about things kind of just being there and revealing themselves to you. So the passage, it's just a couple of sentences here, goes like this. Art as the setting into work of truth is poetry. Not only the creation of the work is poetic, but equally poetic, though in its own way, is the preserving of the work. For a work is an actual effect as a work only when we remove ourselves from our commonplace routine and move into what is disclosed by the work so as to bring our own essential nature itself to take a stand in the truth of being. So, you know, it's about kind of removing yourself from the everyday here. And then also allowing things to reveal themselves to you, which is what libraries and poetry are both about. It's about reading, in a sense, this passage. So I suppose, you know, when you read things, things swim around in your mind. As you say, it's the word we were looking for before was discursive. You know, it's...
Discursive, yes.
Yes, association,
Well, I was just reflecting on the passage, and there's really a sense of standing outside yourself, and removing yourself from the flow of your daily routine and kind of typical thoughts that we have and becoming part of a creative moment or a creation. And I'm thinking of the word inspiration. I mean, and it has to do with breath, right? If you look at the etymology, right? But isn't there a sense of standing outside yourself? For some reason, I'm remembering that I'm going to have to look that word up in my OED and see if there is a sense of that at all.
Yeah. I sense a poem taking shape here. So, so if poetry is all about language talking about itself. So, okay, let's hear another poem. These are just such a delight to hear. Maybe something from the chapter of your book that has to do with the desert itself there and the landscape.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'd love to. There are several poems in the third section of the collection, and the third section I'd like to introduce a little bit has a little section from Rebecca Solnit's Field Guide to Getting Lost.
Uh-huh. An epigram that you start that section with is
really
lovely.
Yes. Getting lost was not a matter of geography so much as identity, a passionate desire, even an urgent need, to become no one and anyone, to shake off the shackles that remind you who you are, who others think you are. Rebecca Solnit, A Field Guide to Getting Lost. So I thought that was my guiding principle for the poems at the end here.
Yeah.
So this one, Turning Off the Flashlight in Golden Pen Mine.
Is this something you actually did?
This is something, I'm struggling to stop. How do I say that?
Yeah.
I took a trip, a camping trip to Nevada about 4.5 years ago now. Met some friends there, but the trip, it was a 6-hour drive to a remote area, dirt roads, and no cell phone reception.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a trip I felt like, I had to do this. It was a weird little act of bravery on my part to do this by myself. And so maybe I did some foolish things while I was there, such as going into an abandoned gold mine. So Turning Off the Flashlight in Golden Pen Mine is a poem about one of the things that I did on this trip. After driving through dry lightning and hillside fire strikes, I'm crouching in the dirt, listening to a voice, the words as fast as the flashlight beams on the mine walls. Whatever you knew before about dark, erase those tapes, because now your ass has been kicked by real dark. So sit down, I'm turning off the lights. And out the flashlight goes. I keep my eyes open for the horror, the terror, so that I may understand the body is nothing, negative infinity, sitting under this mountain now and always. The cells in my head fire off useless memos as pretty little clods tumble down onto my shoulders. Later, emerging into the day, I grieve for the accident I was sure would happen when I followed the voice in.
Hmm. So was this whole journey you were by yourself, the drive out there?
The drive out there, and then I met friends.
Uh-huh.
That were already there. Uh-huh. And so once we were there, we set up camp at a Boy Scout camp, actually. Uh-huh. It's in a location in Mineral County, Nevada,
mm-hmm.
which is, I guess the closest town is Gabbs, Nevada, which is mm-hmm. really a small town. And then maybe the more recognizable name would be Fallon, Nevada, mm-hmm. is the other medium-sized city that's near there. But yeah, this trip that I took out to the desert was really influential for me and gave me so much stuff to work with.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful. It was the end of July, the beginning of August, and there was a storm in the eastern Sierras, so mm-hmm. I had to drive through this big storm. But it was really hot, so mm-hmm. the rain wasn't hitting the ground. It was evaporating, and there was lightning on the hillside around mm-hmm. me and little fires that had started. And I just was, I was really frightened mm-hmm. on my drive out there. Mm-hmm. Right before I went down into the valley where I was told it would be really difficult to find, and because you didn't have cell phone reception, you couldn't call anybody to mm. kind of get help in.
Oh.
And I was told also, once it gets dark, it'll be really hard to find your way if it gets dark.
Yeah.
So try to make it while it's still light. And
mm-hmm.
so right when I'm cresting this mountain range, I guess a small, lowish mountain range, and looking down into the valley where I was supposed to find this really difficult to find spot, I see that there's a storm in that valley, and it's a dust storm, and it's really dark. There's clouds above. that are really dark, and then the floor of the desert is totally blurred from the dust storm. Mm-hmm. And it's late afternoon, and, you know, it's, I can tell that I've got, you know, maybe an hour and a half of light left. And so it was scary. It was really a scary trip. And then I ended up getting lost on the way to the campsite. But then I realized that I had gone the wrong way, so I turned around and tried to double back and find the turnoff I was supposed to take, and somehow I found the crossroads that I was supposed to look for. Uh-huh. And one of the friends that I was meeting at the campsite had left a beer bottle, an empty beer bottle, and weighed it down with something and yeah. stuck a couple of lavender sprigs in it. Uh-huh. He was marking for me, like, that's the place there where you needed to turn right, you know. Okay. So I saw it there. I was in the middle of the dust storm when when I saw it, and I was overjoyed. Like, I found this marker that means I'm finally going to, you know, I'm not going to die out here in the desert in the dark. So anyway, it just, I can't even explain all the different ways in which that trip was important for me, but I've definitely got a lot of poems out of it.
So is this the poem Out of Hawthorne, Nevada?
Yeah, and so that describes that. Should I read that one?
Yeah, sure, if you could. Okay. And then we can talk about maybe both.
All right. Out of Hawthorne, Nevada. We benchmark mapped it last week, this mutilated mountain crest, this dark night of the soul for the soul traveler. But the maps lacked savvy, could not predict the present dust storm. I might hunker down inside the car off the unmarked highway on the invisible gravel next to the other gravel and die. But I descend into these wilds, this out-of-range place on the flats, race the big storm with its white flashes and gold mine goss panorama. Soon I'll pass the sign for Rawhide Road, proof I am lost, forever lost in the desert of adrenaline and alkali sink. No beer bottle vase of lavender to point the way at the mythical crossroads like you said there would be. No search and rescue. No gun in the waistband of your trousers. I am watched from a distant rise. The sky all verga and smudge. The dry thunderstorms in both my homes. Waiting.
So both poems are about a kind of journey, and it's a journey of the self, isn't it? I mean, you are in a kind of quest here, which is, I think sometimes when people travel, it's the case when I travel, especially if I'm alone, I get a feeling, even if I know where I'm going, that I'm searching for something, you know, as we were talking before. I'm out of my normal routine, you know.
Yeah.
And, and, you know, going into the mind there, for me, you know, I'm a medieval person and read a lot of medieval allegory, it reminded me of a kind of going into oneself and interiority. Which is frightening, you know, as Pascal says, the most frightening thing one can do is to be alone, you know, alone with with your own thoughts. So it has that sense. And in that case, you know, you come out of it alive, which is good.
Right.
And maybe changed by the experience. And in this case, with Out of Hawthorne, Nevada, you're lost, whether you know you're lost or not. And then because of a sign left to you by another person, a remarkable kind of sign too, lavender stalks in a bottle, you realize you're not lost. Is there self-exploration to these poems? They're about you, really, aren't they?
As much as I'd like to say that, there's the, you know, the poetic eye and the Stella eye, and they're not the same, but of course they're from me, you know, so... and there is a self-exploration, and there is a sense of getting lost, and the getting lost is so important, so, so important. You know, what you thought you knew about yourself, you know, that gets shattered, and that's a good thing eventually, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Or theoretically, it's a good thing. Yeah. And then you can reassemble or build or whatever with some greater knowledge. Even that sounds kind of weirdly egotistical.
But you know, coming to know yourself, well, I should say, you know, we're recording this shortly after we all got the news that we're going to be living under a government that's fallen into the hands of people who, you know, if we judge them by their words and stated intentions, don't treasure other people or the environment, neither the land nor the things that grow on it, including human beings. And There are people who have acquired power by appealing to fear and what's lowest and meanest in us, not the angels of our better natures, and I'll quote Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And frankly, you know, like all fascists, they're natural enemies of education and communication. And I think, you know, the hostility and the threatening behavior we saw at Donald Trump's campaign rally, especially toward the end there, toward the press, is just the beginning, I think, of the kind of world we can expect we're walking into. And, you know, we're talking about knowledge here, and knowledge of self, and coming to know ourselves. And, of course, poetry and reading are about gathering truth, I suppose is the word, from life experiences, you know, about making knowledge. Libraries are about making knowledge.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something we ought to keep in mind, I think, and nourish however we can. And today on my Facebook site, I posted something that came into my feed from someone who teaches at Pratt here in New York in the Information and Library Science program. Her name is Jessica Hoffman, and she specializes actually in children's librarianship. So I thought, you know, I might read that if it suits in, just as like a way to wrap things up a bit here, I think. And I think it throws light on libraries and poetry both here. So this is a letter to her students, and I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read the pertinent passages of it. It starts out, "Dear students, past and present, this morning I dropped my daughter off at her public elementary school in Brooklyn. There were many tearful goodbyes at the classroom door, tears from parents and children of all colors, cultures, and family structures. Hugs were given freely by her teachers to parents and children alike. I overheard one of her teachers say to a child as he held him in a warm embrace, 'We're still a team. We've got your back. We just have to keep supporting each other like we do.' And then she goes on to say, 'It's been tough going during this election season. It's not going to get easier. There are two things I ask you to foreground this week: self-care so you can carry on, and showing up, really showing up. In my classes, you've no doubt heard me say that everyone is expert in their own lives. You are expert in your own life. Your students are expert in their lives. We can only build understanding and dialogue around our life experiences. Honor truth in your teaching and in your personal practices. Do things that restore you. Talk to friends, talk to coworkers, talk to me, and talk to your students, too. Show up to share and show up to listen. Your students have things to say, questions to ask, learning to do, and they need you now.' And then she goes on to say, 'One of my heroes, Paulo Freire, said that any act that prevents someone from inquiry is an act of violence. We are the first line of defense against that violence. Help your students ask the hard questions and look for answers. Make the library a place that is safe for just the kind of inquiry that those who do violence to our students want to shut down.'" And then, you know, he says, "The power of librarianship is sharing power with everyone. I know you can do it. I'm here to help." You know, I read this morning just before interview here. So, you know, after reading your book and after thinking about public libraries and, you know, the line, "We can only build understanding and dialogue with our life experiences," and that we're all experts. We all should be experts in our own lives. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what, you know, poetry is about, and it's what reading's about.
Yeah.
So,
yes, absolutely.
So I don't know, you know, what more to say about this, but, you know, we do have to carry on here, so doing what we do. It's about creating knowledge and becoming better experts in our own lives, I guess.
Yeah, and sharing that with other people who maybe have never met someone like you before and therefore don't understand you and your world and have assumptions, preconceived notions. So that really resonates with me because I've been thinking about what I can do in my work as a public librarian. I'm the children's librarian for my branch.
Oh, you are.
And I really feel very strongly that now is the time for us to make sure that our public libraries are safe spaces for people, for immigrant communities, for people of color, for Muslims, for anybody who has been marginalized. Well, I mean, women. And so I've been struggling to figure out how I can convey that in the work that I do. I know how to do it in my poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That is, keep on doing what I'm doing and encouraging, really encouraging others to share as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as the poet laureate, I think that maybe I can help facilitate that in my own region here. I'm involved in a poetry contest, for example, called Poets Corner, that the city of Modesto holds every year for the residents. I think I mentioned it a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And so last night, the committee that's directing this contest, or in charge of the contest, we chose the theme for the contest, and it is a line from a Galway Canal poem, mm-hmm. and shoot, I don't have my notes in front of me, but paraphrasing the line, it's about the necessity of getting lost. So the necessity of getting lost before a greater understanding or before you can do the work of rebuilding. And so, you know, we were directly addressing our national situation right now in that theme.
Yeah, we're a whole nation that seems to be lost at the moment.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Wandering in the wilderness, yeah.
Right, and so I feel like art and poetry are more important than ever in this kind of climate. And I'm feeling, you know, all the emotions that everybody else seems to be feeling, the shock. Also, the cynic in me is like, yeah, it always has been like this. Now it just has a name now. You know, we can label it now.
Yeah, Donald Trump.
Right. And now we know what we need to work against. Yeah. I mean, white supremacy and misogyny. I mean, those are twin horrors of our nation.
Yeah. Happily, we have the whole tradition of our nation's ideal behind us.
Right.
This, you know,
yes.
Way back to Thomas Jefferson. And Dewey, well, I'm thinking of John Dewey here in his reading of Jefferson, regarded A, the schools, and B, the public libraries as pillars of democracy. So,
Right. So, I don't know. What to say except that I'm going to keep writing and encourage others to share their truths in their words. At my library, we have an open mic night now that just started a couple months ago, and it's growing in popularity. And I think that that's going to be an important venue for people to express how they're feeling about things. I'm trying to bring together a very small writing community in my library's town to come together to meet and to put on poetry slams or poetry readings on a regular basis. So those seem to be perfectly appropriate responses to me, and healthy ways to process what's going on and to make my library a safe space for people.
Yeah, wonderful. So,
and also, I ordered some Black Lives Matter buttons from a local button maker, and I will wear one in my work, and I will offer them to anybody who wants them. So we'll see how that goes.
sounds like an excellent idea and very productive. Yeah,
well,
so,
you know, and also I have a display case, too, that needs to be filled at my in the lobby of my library, and I am considering, what can I put in there? I see lots of really great resources that can be shared with the public, and I don't want to just put a list of, you know, books on a shelf. I want to have some, you know, text to accompany the display and some images. And so I think it might be like history of protest or civil rights, but I want to tie it into what is happening right now. I have to be careful in my job as a public librarian. I can't be quote-unquote partisan. So,
yeah, but, you know, libraries are all about memory and bringing memory to bear in, in public thought, in a way. So, so that's what we need. We need exhibits and, you know, we need to remember who we are. Okay, so, Stella, I'd like to thank you a million times for being on our show today to talk about your wonderful book of poems, Alkali Sink, published by 16 Rivers Press.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's been really great to talk to you, and I've enjoyed thinking about your questions and reading some of my work.